Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Scroobius Pip, and this is the Distraction Pieces podcast. Thanks for tuning in, guys. More and more amazing reactions recently. The reaction to the Sophia Botella podcast last week was absolutely amazing. I kind of pre-warned people it was one of my favourite ones I've ever recorded, and you all seemed to agree, which was lovely. But what an amazing story that young lady has. So hope you all enjoyed that. I'm sounding a bit sniffly, aren't I? I think hay fever's starting to kick in. I'm away filming at the moment. Previously, I've not been able to mention what it is, but we've now announced it. I'm doing a film called Walk Like a Panther with Stephen Graham, previously of the Distraction Pieces podcast, Dave Johns, previously of the Distraction Pieces podcast, Michael Socker, previously of the Distraction Pieces podcast, Rob Parker, previously of the Distraction Pieces podcast, Neil Fitzmaurice, who's on this week, Christopher Fairbank, who's on next week in a two-parter. So obviously I've been hustling on set to make sure I'm not missing a week of podcasts for you guys. So yeah, it's been amazing. I think you're going to enjoy this one. Before we get into it, speechdevelopmentrecords.com, I mention this every week, that's the sponsor of the podcast, but by God do I have to mention it this week, because you guys have blown me away. So since the last intro, I released my Dark Summer merch, which is swimsuits, swim shorts, leggings, vests, all sorts of stuff, but also some sunglasses that have the label slogan on, which is, we may not be for you, and that's fine. It's kind of I took it on as the label slogan. It was kind of an adaptation of the Millwall. I've been a Millwall fan since I was five. Of the Millwall slogan of, no one likes us, we don't care. It's taking that in a less aggressive manner. I apologise for my sniffling here. As I said, hay fever's starting to grab me. So we released those sunglasses and they look really good. And they went absolutely mental. I'll give the numbers. I'm an open guy. I'd had 300 pairs made because I thought sunglasses, it's an unusual thing to release. I don't know how popular that'd be. They all sold out in the first week. So we have no pairs available. I'm doing everything I can to get more in before July. So we're going to have a new batch in. But if you want a pair of those sunglasses, if you head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com, you can, if you click on the sunglasses, you can put your email address down to be notified as soon as they come in. Because, yeah, there's a good chance that they might sell out again. It's blown me away, so thank you very much to everyone for that. I've been reposting pictures of people in the swimsuits, in the swim shorts, and in the sunglasses. So if you've got them, then tag me on social media, and it's amazing to see. There's also a signed section at speechdevelopmentrecords.com, and you can get my DVD signed, two of my books signed. There's some vinyl in there. There's solo Dan Lesac album, and there's a Lesac versus Pip stuff, so there's loads to choose from. Yeah, just head over there and have a lovely time. On with the podcast. So I mean, we talk about it all, and we can't go into great detail on this particular film, but on my first day I knew in advance, but I was paired up with Neil Fitzmaurice. He's training me and Guz in this film. Again, I'm not going into any detail, but we just absolutely hit it off instantly. Obviously, I was already aware of his work and a fan of his work, so it was lovely to get to work with someone like that. I mean, we're still filming at the moment, and yeah, we kind of were talking a lot on set, and that's what's happened with this and with next week's. It's the two people that on set I was having the most amazing conversations with, and I was just like, look, let's have that conversation on the podcast. So on this week's one, me and Neil found a spare 90 minutes between scenes. So actually on set in the catering section. And then on next week's, we had a spare day. So I sat down with Chris Fairbank, and my Lord, he's such an amazing dude. It ended up being a two-parter. And the first half is all just talking about him growing up in the 50s and 60s and 70s, the amazing story he's got. He's led a mind-blowing life. And then in the second half, I wanted to get into some of his back catalogue, because he's been acting for 40 years. And we only got, because he's got so many good stories, we only got through three things, I think. So Alvin Zane Pett was what made him a huge name. Then we talked about the first Batman film, and he talks very candidly and openly about Tim Burton and about Michael Keaton. And it's amazing. And then we talked about Alien 3. And again, in great detail, he spoke of the things he likes and the things he didn't like. So he's incredibly open. So that's a great one next week. But this week it was amazing to sit down with Neil. And yeah, we cover such a wide range of topics. So I hope you enjoy this one. I'll be back at the end to give you a bit more information on what's to come, to tell you about the Hardcore Listing podcast, which is huge on the network, and they have a live podcast coming. They're recording it August 10th at the Hoxton Bar and Grill, so get there and enjoy that. But yeah, anyway, all that aside, this is episode 154 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Neil Fitzmaurice.
Right, just quickly, I know the intro just ended, but I recorded this intro, or that intro, on Saturday morning. I recorded the podcast on the Thursday, last Thursday. But I wanted to record a little addition to the intro. I didn't want to redo it, because that's not the way. I'm recording this on Sunday morning, and it's post the terror attack on London Bridge and Borough Market. And yeah, you know, a matter of 12 to 14 hours after that attack. Yeah, I just wanted to kind of make mention of it. It's me and Neil in this podcast speak a lot of Manchester's amazing reaction in putting together, and I've seen a lot of the same already from London. One tweet I saw this morning that Moosa Okwonga, that's Okwonga, Okwonga, he reposted that was a quote from the TV of someone saying London should not be cowed, and then a guy's response of mate, the chicken cottage by Boris Station is already open, stop worrying. I love Britain and I love London and the resilience and the reaction to not allow these things to break us down. It's always a weird on social media at times. I like this, and I try not to jump in too much unless I've got something I feel I can add. The general outpouring of sadness is kind of a given. I did one tweet last night in relation to it, but I sent a lot of text messages and talked to a lot of dear friends. The tweet I posted, I recommend you go and have a look at it. It was a link to a video by the aforementioned Moosa Okwonga, who's I've mentioned on the podcast before, and people often hear it wrong or can't understand what I'm saying, but his name is Moosa, M-U-S-A, Okwonga, O-K-W-O-N-G-A. And I posted a link to his video. It's called Heavyweight, and it's also kind of subtitled on YouTube, A Love Letter to London. And that's summed up my feelings on London and on everything last night. Another thing, I got a lot of tweets quoting a specific lyric of mine from a song called Cowboy. So I thought, instead of the regular intro, we'll have a little section from that song to kick this podcast off. Big love to everyone in London and Britain. To anyone who's feeling scared or worried, please don't, or try not to. You know, we're a country that's lived through far worse than these idiots, and we'll continue to move on and go on. I've been pleased. I've not seen I don't know if it's the circles I'm mixing or, again, kind of avoiding social media a bit, but I've been pleased I've not seen the kind of outpouring of fear or hate on any a race or religion. It's definitely worth noting that anyone carrying out an attack like this isn't a true Muslim, is against Islam, particularly doing so during a Ramadan, for God's sake. You're not, these people, no matter what they claim, do not represent the wonderful and strong and amazing and peaceful Muslim people. They're some idiots. In the same way, they don't represent British people. You know, at this point, identities and backgrounds haven't been stated, but I know from the recent terror attacks that these were generally been homegrown British people have been led horrifically astray. So, in my opinion, they stop being British as soon as they carry out these acts, and they stop being Muslim as soon as they carry out these acts. Yeah, that's kind of... I'm not articulating amazingly on this, but a lot of people are. So find those that give you strength and give you guidance. Anyway, let's get on with the podcast.
See, that is London, and that is Britain. We might get scratched and we might get bitten, but even when our heart and resolve is depleted, we won't lay down. No, we won't be defeated. Kid Carp.
Cowboy, get back on your horse. Homeboy, get back on your horse. Root boy, get back on your horse. And find your way before your horse gets lost.
We're recording.
Yes.
I'm sat here with Neil Fitzmaurice. How you doing?
I'm all right, Pip. I'm good, man. Good.
I recorded one of these the other day with Chris Fairbank.
Yeah.
And we had to be all vague about what we're doing. But since that one was recorded and before it's gone out, it's been announced.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
So yesterday they announced Walk Like a Panther.
Oh, excellent.
And that's what we're working on. So we can talk a bit.
Yes.
Obviously, we won't go into tons of detail, but we can say that we've done a scene this morning, and now we've got some hours to kill.
As is the case in this business, yeah.
Yeah, so we thought, let's have a little chat. So we've come to the top deck of the hot catering bus.
Yeah.
I don't know why I chose this, but I thought it was a bit quiet, and we've got a table.
Yeah, it's nice. So we can actually interact. It's like if I close my eyes, we're on a train.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And killing a time on a train with casual conversation. Yeah. That's ideal, right? But, it's been great fun so far, isn't it?
It's been
wicked. We're kind of teamed up in this, and that was lovely because I'm a fan of and aware of loads of your work over the years, and I've been lucky in the two things, because in this and in Taboo I had a fair bit that was improvised dialogue. And in that one I was teamed up with Stevie Graham. And in this one me and Gus Carr are teamed up with you.
Yeah.
So it kind of felt we're in safe hands, and
yeah, man,
it's been a lot of fun so far, hasn't it?
It's been great fun, Pip. It's been great fun, and I always like a bit of ad lib. It's good fun, isn't it? Because you get to stretch your capabilities a little bit, don't you?
Yeah, so. And again, from the first scene, really, it felt our characters knew who they were instantly. So it's quite easy, because we were actually, in fact, I've not mentioned this, I think, it was you, me and Guz were the first scene
of the film,
the whole thing. Yeah, so we were, the crew were all new, everyone was new, and we had a right old laugh.
Some of the crew were different then.
Yeah, the crew have changed a little bit as time has gone on. But yeah, it's been nice to have that freedom, I think, to mess about and ad-lib and enjoy ourselves a bit. It's nerve-wracking for me at times because I'm newer to it, but we've not really had one that's fallen on its arse. It's all been quite...
No, it's good. It's unless they're just really patronising us and going, yeah, that was great, lads. Yeah, that's been good fun. I think you're a man who's not who's known for being able to come up with a word or two.
Yeah, exactly.
Gus is a great athlete because he's a very, very naturally funny guy. Isn't
he? He's wonderful. It's so hard for me. I have to concentrate on my ad-libbing because Gus is doing such a good, like, Brummie accent.
Yeah.
And that's one of my favourite because I lived in the Midlands briefly, it's so hard to keep my character as more kind of, I'm doing more of a London accent. It's like, it's so, every now, there's been a couple of it where I've ad-libbed something and it's just been doing an impression of Gus. It's like, stop it, try and focus and we'll get on with it. I mean, I want to go back and talk about your upbringing and what drew you into comedy and stuff like that and into acting, but while we're here, I mean, it's been while we've been up here that we had the Manchester attack. Yeah. And I don't know, it came to mind because a couple of days after, you and I were on set and you were watching a video after the minute's silence. And I don't know, it choked me up.
Yeah.
Hugely. And obviously, it's horrendous to see things like this happen, but then there's always that moment where it shows you the true beauty of humanity. And that one woman standing up and singing "Don't Look Back in Anger," it genuinely started to choke me up now. Yeah. And then it's spreading round.
It was incredible. Because it was a moment of, you know, things like that aren't rehearsed, and you can tell they're not rehearsed. It's just someone wanting to say something. It's someone just... Yeah. And to have the bravery that she had, I mean, you know, I don't mean bravery as in, you know, she's a fireman, you know, saving lives.
No.
But to have that strength of character to just say, I'm going to say this, whether people, you know, we live in a society where people generally aren't looked upon as being able to speak their mind, you
completely.
And for her to just, it was just a moment of, it was almost subconscious thought that left her mouth. And then people sort of were, you know, there was that feeling at the start of it as this could go really eggy because people were going, well, we're trying to do a minute silence here and you're being... Yeah. But it just sort of spread, didn't it? The emotional thing, and then people joined in and join in, and it was an incredible. It was incredibly moving, and I think it's things like that off the back of disaster and off the back of tragedy and off the back of such horrendous kind of loss of human life that it brings out. You know, you forget about all the crap, and it brings out all the nice in people.
Yeah,
just for a moment.
And I want it to seem like a cliche or stereotype, but it feels even more so with the North. The instant reaction of pulling together and going, right, we're stronger than this and we're going to get through this. Obviously, you're from Liverpool and you've had the Hillsborough disaster in your lifetime and in your life, and it just it always feels like an area and community that will just go, right, we need to. Yeah. To pull together for everyone.
Especially that. I mean, that's a massive part. I'm obviously a Hillsborough survivor, so that was a massive part of my life and something that affected me in many different ways. But I think one of the things that that came out of that was so incredible was the unity and the pulling together of a city and a city generally. But of course, you know, the more people died from outside Liverpool than in Liverpool in Hillsborough.
Oh wow, I didn't know.
The stats are all around the country.
Yeah.
But it was that. I think it was just that particular because it was the hub of it, and because it was Liverpool Football Club. And because there was a huge cover up, massive governmental and you know judicial cover up that people got together and fought it for over 20 years, and it was that constant. I mean, led by families, led by mums. I mean, that was the thing I was.
But that persistence as well to keep fighting, and even that persistence to keep hating publications like The Sun and things like that. Yeah. That continued. It feels like I come from the South. I love the South, but it feels like there's more of a fickleness in the South. I can't see that 20 years on the South would still be going after. I fuck the Sun there, or not even refusing to even say their name and all that. Yeah. I think
people have to understand. I think that because you know people say, "Oh, what's this thing about the Sun?" And you have to understand that. I mean, from my point of view, I was going back down as a 19-year-old kid, deeply traumatised, going back down to the ground to try and with a social worker to try and retrace my steps.
Oh, man.
When that paper came out, and it was passed around the coach of deeply traumatised people who were lost, you know.
Yeah.
and reading stories that that publication put together that day, which was, you know, you've got to remember as well, the Sun newspaper, the editors of the Sun newspaper, Margaret Thatcher,
yeah,
the head of the police, South Yorkshire Police Force, and a Sheffield MP, all met to discuss the terms of blame. Wow. And what they said was they sat down and they made a conscious decision to blame Liverpool fans. So this wasn't a, this wasn't just a Sun reporter writing a story. Mm. This was orchestrated. It was orchestrated to pass blame from the people who were in charge that day to the victims.
Yeah.
And not only saying that it was their fault that they were drunk, that they were out of order. You know, they were, the police took blood samples of 12-year-old dead bodies to try and see if they were drinkers. It went to a level of subhuman behaviour. And it culminated in this publication that basically said, right, not only was it their fault, but here's what they did to stop the police. You know, pickpocketing dead bodies, urinating on dead bodies. They said we were urinating on dead bodies. They said
just completely dehumanised
the victims. And made us so to the entire country, which was a massive publication. Mm. We were to blame, and then you had the hangover of Heysel in 85, which was the 39 football fans died in the Juventus Liverpool European match. So you had that. To which we're still called murderers in every football ground in the country to this day. Every shout that comes out is murderers, you know. And you get the stigma of that added to 89. We were a perfect patsy for that disaster. So that's why, I think that's why, one of the reasons definitely why the city got together with that newspaper and said never again will we, you know, I suppose it's easy to forget and say, oh, well, you know, that. But we don't do that there. You know, we're very much a socialist kind of.
And again, it's a paper that's got a great history of that, and that is by far the most extreme example. But I'm a Millwall fan, so I've had years of seeing the Sun attacking Millwall. Yeah. And one example was there was, and I'm sure I've mentioned it on the podcast before, but it sticks with me, as there was a big expose of a black journalist going and experiencing life as a black man at a Millwall game, and he did this big report saying he saw the Millwall fans doing Nazi salutes and chanting "See Kyle."
Yeah,
and I read that and I was like, "That's disgusting." I've grown up at Millwall. I've seen some racism. I've also seen what the club has done to get rid of it.
Yeah.
I read that like, "Wow, that's unacceptable." Ashamed of my club, I didn't go instantly on the defensive. It was then revealed, and they did a small rescinding article, tiny little thing, that he'd made a mistake. And the "See Kyle" chants weren't the Millwall fans, it was the Brighton fans chanting seagulls.
Wow.
And just pointing, as you do, at opposing fans, that was seen as the Nazi salute. It's like, you've got the wrong fans, you've got the wrong word, you've got the wrong gesture, yet that was a good little story, that. It's Millwall, and they're horrible.
Yeah.
They're hooligans. That's a good story. We've got that there.
And it's that whole thing, which has just recently happened with Kelvin McKenzie, but he's come out again. He was a man who never apologised for all the slander and the lies and the torment he caused the families and the victims. It made me feel worthless for 20-odd years of my life. Never apologised, and then comes out again, gets his job back at the Sun, and then comes out and starts calling Barclay, a place for Everton, the car, starts calling him an ape and a monkey when he has Nigerian parentage. You know, it's a complete lack of any kind of journalistic skill in research and in saying, let's actually look outside the box here and let's just see, 100%. You know, is there a chance that he could have Nigeria? Is there a chance that the Liverpool fans didn't do that? No, they didn't. It was a concerted, orchestrated effort to switch blame. So.
And it's all the more scary now because the lack of journalistic standards is more scary in the days of social media, because we already have to fight the ignorance of us, of the general public, of us tweeting stuff that we haven't researched, of retweeting stuff we haven't researched. So we should be able to turn to our professional journalists for that safety of, right, I can confirm this, but it's gone the other way. They now have to go, oh, what will get us a retweets and pushes on social media?
Yeah.
So the standard has dropped even further. And even less can be relied on in that.
Yeah, and it just goes to show, really, because you can look at it and say, oh, you know, you're making too much of a fuss about it, but actually, in its purest form, it just goes to show the power that the media have to sway opinion, 100%. To sway opinion and thought patterns.
Yeah.
You know, you take that away from Hillsborough and you put it to something like, you know, the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
or the Brexit vote, or one of the things. It just goes to show the power of the media and what it can do to manipulate people's opinions.
Yeah, and it's such a it seems to be such a transparent game as well. Oh, we've just had these, so we're recording this before the vote and the election, and we've just had the polls out saying that it looks like the Tories aren't going to win. Now, they said that about Trump, they said that about Brexit. That now seems like the most transparent thing to scare Tory voters out to go and get their numbers in and vote.
Absolutely.
That's so clear and obvious, and we've seen it twice, yet I'm seeing people going, look at that, they're going to lose. It's like, it's literally year after year at the moment with Brexit and then Trump. It was in a repetitive run of that exact thing of they're going to lose, therefore. It's using the media to say, oh, you're comfortable. Oh, well, don't be.
Yeah.
But to say to the left, be comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's fine. It's like that's such
it's like a magician
control.
Saying pick a card, any card, when they know which card you can pick. They're manipulating that card.
Exactly.
The manipulation goes on and on and on and on. It is horrendous. And with the advent,
it scares me how obvious it is. Yeah. It scares me that it's not even, again, I think there was a Stuart Lee bit where he talked about how the Tories, was talking about UKIP and the Tories, and he was saying, and the Tories who at least have the good manners to hide their ingrained racism. And again, it's exactly that. It's things like this. They're not even hiding the manipulation anymore. They're going, look how obvious this
are you
is.
Stupid?
You
will be. I mean, there was a thing on Twitter today which reminded me of the Brexit vote, which was that famous shot of, I think it was Farage and Boris Johnson or someone, standing in front of this big red bus that said, you know, the EU take £350 million a year, let's put it into the NHS.
Mm.
That manipulated so many people to vote for Brexit.
Hugely.
And then they come out and went, oh, no, we didn't mean that.
Yeah.
He's like, you were standing in front of a bus that literally said it on the side of a bus. What do you mean you didn't mean it? You can't. It wasn't overheard in a pub, casually. Mm-hmm. It was on a bus that is photographed for life. But people saw that and immediately went, right, if I vote Brexit, there's £350 million going back into the NHS. So their reasons for doing it, massive influence factor, which turned out to be a totally manipulative lie, which just goes to show the opinion of the general public when it comes to things like
and
this.
Completely, I mean, part of me also then looks at that and goes, why did we all believe something written on the side of a bus when every election there's manifesto promises that aren't met? And that's written in your manifesto, and you just throw that out the window.
Exactly.
So, of course they're going to throw out the window something they've written on a bus rather than actually pledged and managed. So, it's craziness. But I don't know when this will be coming out. So this could all be redundant and we could be living in a dystopia of horror and pain. But
we could well be, wouldn't we? Well, for what's happened, you know what? I will make no bones about the fact that I'm a socialist viewed person and Labour are a party that, for me, are going to do a lot more good in this country than what we got in.
Yeah,
and I'm hoping that the madness of the electorate's cave carries on going where there's no way Trump was getting in. You know, I remember going to bed. I was doing some work in Manchester. And I was staying in a hotel and I was up early for filming, so I turned the TV off at about 1 o'clock in the morning. When Brexit was never going to happen. So far ahead to remain.
Yeah.
Bop. And then woke up the next day and literally had to say to someone, you know, well, you winding me up.
Yeah.
So
I'd legitimately, and this is embarrassing, I can't remember if it was on Brexit or on the Trump thing, on one of them, before going to bed, I'd written and saved my Facebook post for in the morning.
Yeah.
It was on Trump, actually, because it was so clear that Hillary was going to win. And my post was saying, look, you've made the right choice of the two, but the fight isn't over. Because Hillary is still crooked and dodgy. And it was meant to be a statement of that, of going, look, don't pat yourselves on the back much. Because you've got rid of that devil, but there's another one who's not good.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's keep an eye on that.
It was the lesser of two evils, that, if she got in, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then I woke up and was like, oh,
what are we living in?
Oh, I really overestimated the...
I blame Leicester City Football Club for starting some weird wormhole
of what can't happen does
what
happen.
Can never happen. Can never happen. We all got sucked in and then everything. So I'm hoping that theme continues and we end up with a government that, you know, give us shit.
Yeah, that'd be nice. That'd be a nice surprise. Yeah. Continuing on, I guess, as we've touched on Liverpool.
Yeah.
A Little Boy Blue recently was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Deserves all the plaudits it's getting. I remember talking to Stevie on Taboo when he just accepted that, and it was one of the most nervous roles for him to accept because of knowing how much it meant to him and to everyone.
Yeah.
And in my mind, what better person as your lead in The Detective? Because Stevie, I remember on one of the days of Taboo, he stayed at mine when we were filming, and there was a Liverpool match in the semi-finals of the UEFA Cup. And there's no better way to watch a Liverpool match than with Stevie, because he's the most Scouse person in the world. And was just like, I'm sitting there enjoying it. He's jumping up and shaking
Dortmund, does
it? Yeah, he's jumping up and shaking me, and it's all in amazing intense. But yeah, how was that to work on your speech? I think in episode 2, I think it was, at the funeral was unbelievably moving. And again, I think the choice, it's interesting. There's a film I like called The Battle of Algiers, and it's about the Battle of Algiers, and it was filmed about 5-6 years after that actual battle, and a lot of the people in it were involved in that uprising, and it felt like an amazing bit of casting because it's drawing and it felt similar in this, that they cast a lot of people who they knew have an emotional attachment to this story. So in a weird way, you're not having to act too hard because you know that emotion, you know how you felt. So how was that to work on and to tell that story and do it justice, I guess?
Well, firstly, I think you're right in the sense that, again, it's that thing, maybe it's a Liverpool thing, maybe it's a national thing, maybe it's just a thing that when it's in your city and you remember it and it's still quite raw, it was only 10 years and it was such a strange thing to happen there because it was a 12-year-old kid. I guess in many ways it's the James Bulls here as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it stays with you. And I initially went for a meeting for the father,
right,
to play Stephen, and
and
spoke to the directors and stuff, and then didn't hear anything. And then my agent phoned and said, "Look, the Stephen thing has worked out because they're looking for lookalikes." And I said, "I get that. You should." Completely. There's nothing worse than going through all this and having someone go, well, he doesn't look anything like
it. Particularly when it's a fresh story, a new story, there is familiarity. Yeah,
and also so important to get right. So I was like, yeah, absolutely fine. Yeah. So they said, well, there's the part of funny enough, his name is Neil, the part of the uncle. And I said, well, what is it? She said, well, it's not really in it. So as an actor, you know, you go through years of doing parts and you get to a point where if a part's too small, you don't want to do it.
Sure.
Because, you know, you're worth, it's that, you know, you're constantly in our profession being told that you're not good enough or you're not right. So you get to a stage where if you get offered bits, you just think, well, I don't really want to do that.
It's protecting your value
as well.
And we have that as touring artists. Yeah. You get to a certain point and even if there's a gig you really want to do, if it's that much of a drop down, it's making it look like that's what you know what I mean? It's protecting. Yes. Like you've done a lot. My argument was, not me, but my agent has done a lot to get me up to this level.
Yeah.
Therefore, out of respect to him, as much as anything, I need to remain at this
absolutely
level.
Absolutely. And I think it's something that comes from stand-up as well, because I'm a stand-up comic. And
you can
do the same club for 6 or 7 years, and they won't put the money up.
Yeah.
Until you go, listen, you need to put this money up now.
Yeah.
Because I've been doing it for 6 years, and I've gone X, Y, and Z since then.
Yeah.
So it's all that. It's just a self-preservation thing. So
or you do another club as a favour, and they happen to let everyone know how much they paid you, and suddenly it's like, well, I know you did that. It's like, mate, that was a one-off.
Yeah, but it's that. It's all a self-preservation, and it's making you just looking after yourself. So so she said, yeah, there's the part of it. And I said, well, you know, it's not really much to do. It's three scenes, and there's only one scene with dialogue in.
Yeah.
Which usually I would say no to be honest with you. But she said, well, it's reading the poem. And it was just by some weird coincidence, because I was prepping for the meeting to go to play Stephen, the father. I put some things on YouTube, and one of them was an ITV documentary. It wasn't a documentary, it was a factual documentary, obviously, that dealt with the whole Rhys Jones thing and spoke to Stephen and Melanie. And the start of it was Stephen reading the poem, and it was so haunting.
Right.
That when she said that, I felt, oh, that sort of hit me inside. And I thought, I've heard that. And my immediate thing was that I know I could get that right.
And
then it suddenly became a thing of like, this piece, you know, some pieces you want to be a part of because you want to make sure that even in the tiniest roles, there's someone who can do a good job. And then you have good strong foundation 100%. Parts all the way around it.
Yeah, that's a great point to get to put your level of experience and your level of emotional attachment into what is essentially a small role, but I mean, it's a crucial role because of that poem, because of that moment and that piece.
And I suddenly felt a sense of responsibility to get that right and to get it right for them. Okay. And because it was then an offer, so it wasn't a case where I had to go and, you know, flog myself to get it. So and for reasons that will become clearer as the story goes on, it was important that someone experienced did that role, because when we got down to doing that scene, that was there was 250 essays or extras in the cathedral where the funeral took place. And it was carrying the coffin down and stuff. And it was, of course, it wasn't, you know, it was a really difficult... My utmost respect goes out to Steve and Stephen Graham and to Sinead and to Breen O'Brien, who played Stephen, because that wasn't a fun job to be on, in the sense that it was... You know, you had to chat to people and you had the odd laugh, but it was such an intense set.
Yeah,
an
intense experience. Right,
it had to be, of course, every single day. So it was a really intense part to do, and then we got to the cathedral. But what struck me when I got to the cathedral was all the cameras were facing away from where I was going to be standing.
Right.
Which told me, as an experienced actor, that all the main shots they were going to be doing were going to be on the people reacting to what I was saying.
Yeah.
Not what I was saying.
Yeah.
Or not me saying it.
Yeah.
So that then, because I'm experienced, I knew that then I had to obviously give a performance for the reactions, but I had to keep a bit in the tank because they were going to come on me last.
Right, yeah. So you're going to have performed it numerous times to get everything else, and then when it comes back
to me,
you need to still
have
that,
a bit in the tank. And these are things that only come in with experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, somebody not as experienced will have belted it out two or three times. And then when it gets to him or her, they've got no... And I don't use tear sticks. I don't use any kind of things. I try to bring it from inside. So that's what I did. I literally did about six or seven passes.
Yeah.
Getting up from carrying the coffin,
wow.
Sitting down, then getting up and coming up and reading the speech. And I wanted to make sure I got it right for the reactions for the other people anyway, it's important to me. And I did, I know I did, and even, you know, Stephen came up to me and said, mate, you got me every single time.
Yeah,
and most of the essays in the room who come over said, that was... So I knew I'd got that right, and then what happened was they turned the cameras around and everyone left.
So the shot was on me, then on my own. Oh, man.
With a camera about 6 foot in front of me. Even the microphone that I'd been speaking through, which give it that gravitas in a cathedral. Sound man come over. As you know, sound department will come over and say, do us a favour and try not to breathe in this take because we can hear it. So I had to turn that off. So the shot that was on me to do it was a complete sort of lie. Because So that's when experienced actors need to be doing them roles. I think, because anyone who maybe wouldn't have been as experienced, would have gone, oh, hang on a minute, where is everyone?
Yeah.
You know? So.
And there's that weird feeling of, oh, we're kind of at the end of this kind of, not that you want to rush it, but that you are like, well, it's all on me now.
Yeah.
I'm the last thing.
Yeah.
Kind of, is that all right?
And also, when you're playing a small role, you tend to get thought of as a small role. So yeah. I, in the back of my mind, knew that most of that speech is going to be one. I think it shot back to me once.
Yeah.
The rest of it was on the thing, but I knew that was going to happen. And it then became a case of like, well, you've got a job to do.
Yeah, you need to make sure that it's.
Yeah, and you know, I'm very, very proud of that little moment that was in there because I'm very proud of the piece. I mean, Stephen, I pulled Stephen to one side after I watched the last episode, and it was a wonderful moment at the end of Little Boy Blue, where it's all on Stephen following him through the house. Mm. There's the barbecue, and it links then in a circle because at the start of the piece he gets a phone call just as he's getting to his family's barbecue and he has to leave. So they had that lovely moment when he's just been betrayed by the police force, passed over for promotion after doing a great job, but all he ever did was looked after that family.
Yeah.
And then he comes back to his family, and there's a wonderful moment where it's just on Stephen's face, and you can always tell the gravitas of an actor when they are telling you everything and saying nothing. And it reminded me, and I told him it, and he was really touched by it. But it reminded me of one of the best moments of that for me growing up as a kid was watching The Long Good Friday with Bob Hoskins.
And it's
the scene at the end in the car when, as a viewer watching the film, you know this man's fate.
Yeah.
You know, and he goes through this cycle of emotions without saying anything. And he goes through, it's almost the stages of guilt and then you denial and then.
Yeah.
And it's done without any words.
I love it, yeah.
And that Stephen's reactions were as close as I've ever seen any actor get to that.
Yeah.
Because I watched him walk through his house,
yeah,
feeling angry and betrayed, upset at what he'd, proud of what he'd, yeah, done, and then get to his family, and it was and then acceptance that he was no longer going to do that anymore. He was going to be a father, yeah, and a husband, and he did it without opening, yeah, his mouth. And I said to him on the set of this the next day, I told him that, and he was really touched by it, I think. But it was really powerful.
I love that. I love that. I love the thought of that in a script as well. That they're saying, this is the big close where we have to get everything across. And I don't think there's any dialogue that can do that.
No,
but it has to just be all on you.
But there are a lot of actors and actresses who couldn't do that. Yeah, that's the thing. It takes a really special kind of talent to be able to convey that much. And Stephen's got it in bucketfuls, hasn't he?
Amazing. Yeah, 100%. So let's go all the way back to growing up in Liverpool, is it? You were
Born in Anfield, by the ground. Oh, yeah, wow. Yeah. Born and bred in Anfield, St Domingo Vale, which is the initial name of Everton Football Club before they changed, and then Liverpool took Anfield. Everton gave Anfield to Liverpool
and moved to
another place. So I'm from St Domingo Vale, which is just, you know, I could see the cop from my bedroom window. It is the old kind of classic story, you know.
So yeah, you would have, anyone in Liverpool grows up a football fan, but I live in there, that must have been from day one.
Well, it's interesting because we are, I think it's only Notts County and Notts Forest, I think, have the nearest football grounds. But Liverpool and Everton's football grounds are separated by a tiny park, so it's... So there are lots of Evertonians
I've always felt Millwall and Charlton are close, and Millwall and Palace, but it's nothing compared to that. There's literally, as you said,
you can walk from Anfield to Goodison in about 4 minutes. It's literally just around the park. So there are obviously, you know, scattershots everywhere. But I mean, I guess it's just you grow into your family's thing as well, don't you?
Yeah.
We were a family of Liverpool fans.
I say I don't think you should be allowed to choose your football team. Yeah. You inherit it.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. I guess if your parents weren't into football, then you get a little bit of choice, but it should be choosing via a map.
Yeah.
And looking that's my team then.
Well, which is completely foreign now, pardon the pun, in football, because of FIFA and FIFA 17 and FIFA 16 and all these online games, kids. I mean, you do get kids. They're all in Arsenal kits or Chelsea kits. And I'm like, where are you from? And I've got four boys, and I said to all my kids, look, you're not getting a Chelsea top. You're not getting it.
Yeah.
If you want a football kit, I'll buy you one. It's going to be red.
Yeah.
It's going to have a Live Bird on it. If not, wear something else. You know what I mean?
I remember my dad's discomfort when I was at the age of about, I guess, 10 or so, and I said, look, I've been going to Millwall since I was five. I was like, look, I'm thinking of supporting Liverpool because they were the team at that point at my age. Yeah. I was like, and he said, well, look, we're playing them this season, but we're going up to Anfield for it. He said, go and decide there. And I said, look, I'll support the winner. Thinking, easy, job done, it's Liverpool. It was a draw, but Millwall scored first. So my dad was like, well, it's Millwall then, right? I was like, yep, I guess so. And it has been ever since. But again, That's right. That's how it should be. So
I think so. I think it's. I mean, you know, everyone's allowed to support who they want, but just not in my house.
Exactly. So what was? What kind of kid were you? Was comedy always part of your life, and were you influenced a lot by comedians or sitcoms or anything else?
I think I'm the youngest of four lads.
Right.
And I think I was probably influenced, as the youngest is, by his brothers. Your brothers bring a lot of influence to you.
Yeah.
Your siblings, your older siblings. My eldest brother, Peter, is a very, very funny lad, very, very dry, very, very... whenever you try and say something off the cuff, he'll always beat you. He'll always say something where you go, oh. And he grew up listening to the Goons tapes and Spike Milligan. And so I sort of grew up, I think, with a richer seam of comedy than what was going on at the time, which was, you know, TV comedy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Although the Benny Hills of the world, I love all that stuff. But in that world of sort of sitcom-y, The Good Life and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to the Spike Milligans and the Peter Cooks and the Goons and the Monty Pythons.
So definitely the kind of underground and rebellious areas of comedy, rather than just
very satirical. Clean and safe. Yeah. I mean, there was, but of course, when for instance, when we sat down to write Phoenix Nights, I think the one thing we all had in common was that our heroes, both in performance and also in scripts, were, you know, your Porridge,
yeah,
your Rising Dan.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Leonard Roster is one of my heroes.
Yeah.
For if you look at the, again, talking about saying stuff without saying stuff, you look at the, because most good comedy is based on failed humanity. It's based on failed humans. It's based on, it's based on failed relationships, you know. So that the Only Fools and Horses is exactly the same structure as Steptoe and Son.
Yeah,
there's a bit more love in that one, but it's the old can't live with, can't live without. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and things like Porridge and things like that, they definitely thrive on the lack of scenarios rather than the abundance of scenarios. It's not rammed with quote. Like the reason they're great is that they've given themselves a restriction. Here's where we are. Here's what we've got. That's not going to mean that we can go off and do all these crazy, zany adventures. It means you're going to have to fall in love with the characters and their interactions and their moments and their small little looks they give each other and asides and stuff like that, rather than the grand thing of, well, a dog's going to get loose and then it's going to cause all this mayhem. It's like, right, no, you've not
and in, and in a similar way that Steptoe and Son very rarely left the yard and Rising Damp never left the house. I mean, it is that feeling of, I mean, the follow-up to Porridge was going straight and that was him out and it didn't work.
There's too much freedom. There's too much to play with.
So they were my influences, I think, growing up. Probably not knowing it at the time, but growing up, I think. I think I had an acuter sense of comedy and I'd like to say a more refined sense because, but and more anarchic as well, more sort of, you know, thinking off the cuff. And
So what was your route into comedy itself? Did you come first into stand-up or was it in writing and acting? And because the first thing that I became aware of you on was with Peter Kay Show and then A Phoenix Nights, obviously. Yeah. So were you already a stand-up at that point and doing the club scene?
Yeah, I was, but everything I've ever done has been an offshoot of wanting to act. I mean, acting is the passion of it, the main passion that I have. Yeah. I mean, I can remember being in school and doing a drama lesson. And we had a teacher called Mr. Milner, and he said, right, it was English, essentially, but he said, we're going to do drama within this English lesson. And I remember thinking up a play and putting it on, and I remember just coming out of it going, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
It was that.
Did you get anyone tell you were good in that situation? Because a repeating theme I found on the podcast, I had it with Chris, I had it with Riz Ahmed and numerous others, is at some point as a youngster, they've done acting, they've been acting, and someone, a grown-up, has said, you're really good at that.
Yeah.
And that small thing, because you realise, particularly with Chris, 50s, 60s, but even 70s and 80s, Britain wasn't a place of abundance of praise for children.
No.
So that moment of, you're good at that, is like,
I
want, number one, I want to do it more, but number two, I want to hear that more.
Yeah,
I want to be told by a grown-up that I'm good at something more. Yeah. So was that a similar thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was also when I started doing drama in school, I mean, you know, I knew what I wanted to be, but no one else in my family did, so there was none of that.
Right.
None of that encouragement from that side of
things. Yeah.
But yeah, it was me teaching Mr. Milner, who said, because I was taking the book home every week and writing everything. I was just going, I'll do it, because nobody else really wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And he was the first person to say, you know, you've got a real knack for this. You've got, you've got a maturity to what you're doing, and also you want to write as well. So it was an interesting, it was probably the first indication of a writing path as well.
Yeah.
So I did it in school, first of all, and then I always remember, because I used to sort of traverse the line between being artistic and being a scally as well, because I had my gang of mates and
playing footy
and hanging about in shops and stuff. And
I think those two things can come hand in hand a lot of ways as well, because it feels like anything in the arts is in some way avoidance of being maths or, you know, working in an office. It's kind of go, what can I do that means I'm not going to work in the office? What can I do that means I'm still going to be able to wear jeans and a t-shirt to work? So I think there's always that fine line of finding the dedication for it as well as just finding the passion for it.
Well, I remember sort of, so I was doing this night school course in Liverpool by where I live, Stanley Park, and then one day a week, and then one night a week, and then the rest of the night just hanging about with mates and being places we shouldn't be and doing things we shouldn't do.
Yeah.
And I always remember this particular, it was a Wednesday night or something, we were in the hall of this school doing these, the teacher had us doing walks, like old man walks, and studying the way people walked and stuff. And we were all doing this in a line. And then I heard a bang on the window, and I turned out it was all my mates who found me, caught me.
Oh, wow.
And they had the ball in one arm, and they were like, Fitzy, what are you doing? Come on. You know, yeah. All laughing and stuff. And it was a real kind of, it was a real moment for me of going, okay, you either stay here,
yeah,
or you leave the class and you go and play football with your mates, yeah, and then just, yeah, say, oh, you were pissing about, whatever. And the teacher saw the moment, it was like a bit of an epiphany, and she saw it and she said, it's up to you, you know.
Yeah,
I think you've got really a choice to make here, I think you've got something special you can do, and, or you can go and it's fine. And I stayed, and I just went, nah, fuck, you know. And a few of these lads, a few of those lads ever since. In fact, most of the lads I went to school with and knocked about would have all gone, maybe we're proud of what you've done.
Yeah.
Which is lovely, it's a lovely affirmation.
I love that. For years I really enjoyed, there's a spoken word artist called Polar Bear. He's, yeah, a Brummie, he's a really talented lad, he's hilarious. And he always, I used to say, for a lot of his sets, he'd think, what if my mates walked in now? So he'd never try and bring himself to the level of this. There was an open mic at RADA, and we were very much the working class ones. We were out of place, but we were always, but we're not going to try and be that. So his yeah, thinking was always that. And I had him on the podcast recently, and I asked him about that because I always thought that was an interesting outlook. And he was saying he'd changed it because he realised, well, no, he now feels, number one, his mates would think, well, it's Stevie doing it.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's, you know, I mean, regardless of what we would think, yeah, therefore it's that. And number two, he'd want to show them why he's doing it. So rather than holding himself back, yeah, to what would my mates think, it's, yeah, kind of going now more the route, a choice that you made in that, yeah, moment of going, fuck them, I'll, yeah, take a few, yeah, digs, yeah, I'll take a bit of mockery, I'll, yeah, take a bit of a laugh because I believe in this.
And that's they're the moments, I think, that, I mean, and the sad thing is the moments that can sometimes swamp people up.
Yeah.
People can go and play football instead, yeah, of staying and, yeah, listen. That's the sad thing of it, but we don't know. I don't know what it is. I think if I have any talent at all, my biggest talent is that I have the ability to go the other way, to go, fuck you, I'm gonna,
yeah,
and certainly my acting career, it's always been, I've always felt like I've been trying to prove people wrong, and
yeah, it's a massively important thing. It's weird. I got a text off my mate last night just because he'd seen the announcement of the film, and I don't talk about any work stuff really because I do a lot of different things. It's like I don't want to be, I'm doing this now. And I got a lovely a text off a mate, and he said almost exactly that. He said, the thing that I like the most is that you're happy to just go, no, I want to do this.
Yeah.
Like, fuck everyone else. This is what I want to do. Yeah. This is what, and it might work, it might not work, but you're kind of happy to do that. And I went back to him, I was like, that's the nice description of it. The not nice description of it is stubbornness and things like that. That I'm like, well, no, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Forget it, I'm doing it. It's like, but again, it's.
I think it's a massive,
it's a positive trait.
I think it's a massive thing to have, especially in the acting profession. It's such a hard profession.
Yeah.
And I from time to time, yeah, you get actors. I remember doing a TV show. There was a long-running TV show, and I just come in to do these three like feature-length episodes.
Yeah.
And this kid had just left drama school and gone straight into it. He'd been in it for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, a regular.
Yeah.
And then found out that he was getting written out. A lot of them were. New producers come in and, you know, you know, get, you know, suddenly there's a car bomb or a, and all that after the year, you know, the thing's gone. So he said, I'm being written out. And I said, well, don't worry about it, mate. And he went, no, I think I'm getting out of this business. And I went, why? He said, well, because, you know, I've been written out. And I went, good, get out of your way.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. I said, good, do it. Because you know what? The less people with that attitude in my profession is better, the better, or the better.
Yeah. There was a young lady who played Brighton in Taboo with us, and she had found out that she was being killed off. And a few people were finding out about being killed off and reacting in different ways. And her reaction was beautiful because she just went, I want to make this as good a death as I can. I want to make this as good for the scene and for myself.
Yeah.
And we discussed, I was like, well, yeah. If your intention is to be in acting for the long haul, then 2-3 seasons in a show is still only going to be a few seconds on your show reel.
Yeah.
If there's a good death scene in there, that's probably the few seconds that are going to make it onto your show reel, rather than this 2-3 seasons in the background. Yeah. Well, that's a great outlook.
I mean, this is the acting profession. It's the best job in the world. I love it. When you're working, when you're not, it's really, really difficult. And I think there are elements that make up a good professional actor, and they are your ability to be able to cope with work, by that I mean not turn to an arsehole.
Yeah.
You know? And your ability to be able to cope with not being in work. And I think if you can master those two, if you can keep on the floor when everything's going your way, and not lose yourself and not be a tit.
Yeah.
But on the other side of the coin, you can really be strong for yourself when people are saying no continuously. No, continuously.
Do you think but being a writer helps you on that, to give you something to do in that time, to give you like, right, the roles aren't coming in, I'd make mine. I wrote a pilot recently, and part of that was I was having an amazing time in auditions, but then I thought, hang on, I'm resting on my laurels a bit here. I'm going, I'm getting up for some good roles. This is it's all sorted.
Yeah.
But then I went, well, no, I've never had that attitude the rest of my career. Yeah. While I'm going in for these auditions, I can try and create the roles I want that I'm not going up for.
Yeah, absolutely.
I write them myself and create this myself. And that's, even if it never comes to anything, I think that's a great thing to keep your mind ticking over and to keep you creative and busy.
And I think you'll know this more than most, but some of the happiest moods I've ever been in have been after a day's writing.
Mate,
because you feel that sense of, because you're constantly putting barriers up and then knocking them down and walls up and knocking through them. And if you can do if you my missus will say to me, oh, you're in such a great mood. I'll go, no, because I found a way of getting through this.
Mate, I can relate instantly. You know? I won't go into detail on the podcast, but we've discussed. Last Friday, I had a less than ideal end to my day up here. There was a few problems.
Yeah.
It went wrong and I had a 4-hour drive home. And 3 hours of that, I was in a rotten mood. And then in the last hour, I had an idea for episode 6 of a thing that I'm writing. And by the time I got home, I was buzzing. Because I had this idea and I was like, right, I've not written episode 4. Yeah. I've not written episode 3. But had this idea for episode 6. And in that last hour, I planned out 70-80% of the whole thing. And I was
amazing, isn't it?
Wow. This is that buzz and excitement of I've got this in my head. I'm talking it out in the car as I'm going. I'm skipping through my songs and selecting songs to go in scenes.
It's amazing,
as I'm driving,
isn't it?
And
it's an amazing feeling. It's a feeling I don't get with acting. It's a feeling that, I mean, obviously if I do a good day's work and acting, then I go, I'm buzzing over that.
Yeah.
But there's something about the creation of things. And I did it recently with my son. My youngest son was the whole class was asked to write a story. And
thought you were going to say the literal creation of things then. I created a song. The sense of achievement.
My son's just a story writer. And I ended up writing it with him, and it was such a connection. It was an incredible connection. And because, you know, kids these days have got their heads in iPads. And for him, I could see him.
Yeah.
I could see him literally shaking cobwebs off because his brain was going... And I was saying, well, what about if this happened? And he was going, and what about... And I just thought, wow, man, how incredible. Sounds really cliche, but
that's beautiful.
I think everyone should be. We should be nationally conscripted not to go join the army, but to write something. To everyone, you know. And I think it's all locked inside us, isn't it? And some people think they're worthless, and some people think that they have no.
It's having people who can get that out of everyone. Yeah. And I've spoken about it numerous times, but again, that same guy Polar Bear, he does a lot of stuff in schools, and I've been asked to do stuff in schools before, but I think it's an underrated art. Like, it's a skill that you have to learn.
Yeah.
And I don't have that. And I remember talking to Polar Bear one day, and he was saying about... I shouldn't mention it so much, because it's giving away his tricks. But he was saying how he'd been in this school. And he went in and he asked them all what they did at the weekend. And he was there for creative writing and poetry. So he was like, and storytelling. He's like, what did you do at the weekend? And a few of them said, and he went, right, now, everyone grab a pen and write a lie about what you did at the weekend. Because that simple thing, a lie is exciting, and lying is exciting. So it's instantly that, it's not write a story, it's like write a lie about what you did. So it's like, I did this. And again, it just instantly had everyone excited. It's those simple things to get to start that fire off. And it might not burn forever, but it's giving it that option and that chance to... Yeah.
Well, Chris Evans does that 500 words thing for Radio 2, and some of the entries to get to the final are extraordinary. Yeah, and then you go, what, there were 8?
Are you serious?
And you think that's inside them.
Yeah.
And it's just about getting out. So I love that. I mean, I love the. It's always been a bit of a crutch to fall back on, because, as I said, everything's been an offshoot. Everything I've done has been an offshoot of acting and the ability to not be able to act. So stand up came about because my brother's had a pub in Liverpool,
yeah,
like a wine bar, And, you know, I made a conscious decision when I was a kid. And I didn't want to go to London. I didn't want to train in London. I would have trained in Liverpool, but I'm from such a close family.
Yeah.
I simply didn't want to leave my family. I didn't want to leave my mum and dad. And I didn't want to leave my brothers.
Yeah.
And my friends. So I didn't, you know, I think a lot of people who go away to drama school and stuff, I think there's an age to go and get away, or there's an age to find themselves. I never had that age.
Yeah.
And then with that age, the more I was getting into my acting, I've always seen the visuals of things. I've always been able to look at something and go, this would be a really good scene if this happened then. And I don't know why, I just see things in scenes sometimes.
Yeah.
And then it became apparent to me that I wanted to write a film in Liverpool. Liverpool's one of, I think outside London, it's the most filmed city in Europe. It's extraordinary, the buildings. It's got the most grade two list of buildings outside of London in the country. And it has an incredible span of architecture and different depths of architecture. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, a lot of stuff set in New York is done on the Dock Road because they have those zigzag fire escapes and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So I always used to walk around the streets of the pool going, this would be a great place to do. So that kind of, that took me away from wanting to go to drama school. But in the meantime then, I had no chance as an actor. I had no agents. I had no... You know, I'm from Liverpool, I stayed in Liverpool, I wasn't in London, I wasn't where everything was happening.
Yeah.
So it was a real struggle, and for 10, 11 years I didn't do anything. It was really, really difficult. I did, I got a little bit in Brookside when it was about...
I was going to say, if you're from the south, the route is EastEnders, the Beale casual. If you're from the north, Coronation Street, at that time Brookside, still the Beale.
Yeah.
You know, that's
everyone. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So that's an international one but it seems to me that's kind of the route in, but I don't know. Oh, and Emmerdale as well, I guess. But again, I love that is kind of a set. Yeah. Like, you'll be stunned at how many actors I have on that you go back and it's like, all right, there's EastEnders or The Bill or Casualty.
I'm wonderfully as well camera operators and writers. And you know, Jimmy McGovern, one of our best writers, was a Brookside writer.
And I guess, again, it's logical, because the logic is it's on... Constantly.
Yeah.
So you're going to need a constant run of actors and cast and crew, essentially, because it's like, well, it's never ending. It's been going for so long, it's not like a series where, well, we'll shoot our 8 episodes and then we wrap for a year. It's like, no, we need people now.
You need a revolving door of stuff going on.
So it makes sense.
But I didn't work for a long, long time, and I was, my brother said to me, you're a funny lad, why don't you do some stand-up? And I went, well, you know what? He went... And I think I was drunk this night, and I went, yeah, I'll do it here. I'll do it in the bar. And he went, yeah, we can do it in the wine bar. Like, next Thursday, or whatever, you know. And I went, yeah!
Let's do it.
And then sobered up, and then he said to me a couple of days later, you know, you're doing this thing on Thursday. And I went, doing what? And he went, are you doing this comedy night? And I went, no. There might have been a couple of Thursdays away. And he went, you are, because I've had posters printed, and I've paid for them.
Amazing.
So it was literally a case where I got me a mate, and I went, do you want to do it with me? And he went, yeah, we'll have a go. And it was, I can remember we filmed the first couple I did, and my body language was incredible. I had the mic in one hand, and I was scratching my back, talking. It was so uncomfortable to watch.
Trying to look casual.
Just awful. But I've said, you know, in the past, that regardless of my acting background, and regardless of what because I'd done a lot of theatre and stuff by then, my first stand-up gig was like a horror that I'd never... It was a terror that I'd never experienced before. Yeah. You may have done it with your first spoken word, but because it was all mine, because it was...
It's you
laying yourself bare. You know, I hadn't been the character that Shakespeare wrote. You know, I hadn't been... And I can remember my heart beating. I could feel... You could see the pulse in my neck. It was that...
Right.
You know, So I'd been, you know, piss-balling about a bit in the wine bar, but then I entered the competition in the Everyman Theatre, which was a stand-up competition, started doing a bit more, and that was when the real terror started, because that was a big audience of people expecting something funny, you know what I mean? And then it just went from there, really. I mean, I think stand-up's all about experience, like everything else, I suppose, but, you know, that was back
in... You need to get those hours in.
That was in the mid-90s, and I left school in the 80s when Liverpool was... I mean, it was a wreck of a city.
Yeah.
You know, Thatcherism and...
Of course.
I just destroyed it. It was most of my mates. A lot of my mates went in the same class as me. Were all heroin addicts by then.
Oh wow!
That was sort of the biggest option you had leaving school in Anfield. I was in Anfield Comprehensive, which is 1,200 lads. You know, we had teachers raped. We had teachers attacked. It was just a really, really rough place to grow up.
It's a hell of a at City Liverpool, and it seems to be on a constant turnover and constant movement. Like from Turin, even in the last 10 years, it's the city that I'll seem to, each time I return, either new places have opened or new places have boarded up. It seems to be such a weird constant cycle. It's never
in flux. It's a strange one, because I say, I can remember the 80s Liverpool, which wasn't a nice place at all. There was nothing. But and Liverpool, you've got to remember, Liverpool from the Second World War was one of the most important cities, and before that was one of the most important ports. I mean, you know, unfortunately one of the contributors to the slave trade, but a lot of its wealth was a lot of its grandeur, a lot of its buildings, a lot of its architecture was based on the back of slaves, unfortunately. But then the city was an important city, a big port, and then it just, Manchester took over and realised that shipping wasn't the way it was going to go. It was going to go through the canals and the cotton industry, and then took over, and it was, and Liverpool was really beaten, and it was on its knees for a long, long time. And I mean, I would say as well, up until the 2000s, the capital of culture, getting the capital of culture changed the landscape of Liverpool forever.
Completely, yeah.
It meant that development had to come into it. It meant that people had to stop bullshitting and doing something about it and making it look nicer.
And a hell of a development as well. Like, incredible. Some of the work that's been done in the last 10 years or 20 years is just amazing.
Incredible.
It's beautiful.
And it's brought... And I had a lovely statement a good few years ago now that I've nicked and openly nicked and told the guy I nicked it. And he said, Liverpool's got its swagger back.
And
Liverpool is a swaggering place. It is a place that was cocksure of itself for a long time, but then it didn't. Then it got defensive and insular, and, you know, almost we wanted our own passports, you know what I mean? Because we weren't part of... And it's starting to flourish again, and it's a great city. It's a much maligned city, and it's a great city.
Do you think any of that was down to the push Scouse stereotype? Like, it became a big thing with Harry Enfield and that kind of thing. As simple as that sounds, it became a laughable thing.
Huge.
The Scousers were this... Again, dehumanised, as we've said before in more serious situations, but there was a dehumanisation of Scousers because they became a stereotype, and they became a thing rather than a people. That's going to make you lose a lot of your identity and a lot of your...
And it was the programmes that did it. I mean, if you look at Boys in the Black stuff by Alan Bleasdale, that is an incredibly moving and powerful portrayal of a city that was on its knees. And he tells it in such an incredible way, and it tells about the fight that people had to survive, to eat, to find the money to eat. And there's a great scene in one of Boys in the Black stuff when Michael Angelis and Julie Walters, you forget the cast of it in as well. They've got no money at all, the skins, and he finds money down the side of the couch. He rips the couch to pieces, and he's finds like £4. And they're fucking out jumping up and down because they can go and get some chips. And that was how it was for a lot of people. It was real. And then you put that alongside Bread by Carla Lane. That just absolutely demonised and destroyed any credibility that our city had by making us a load of scrounging dolelites who were only interested in making money on the sly. And only interested in making money with an angle. And everything was all right, that. And it just put this horrible, sinister... And it was so badly put together.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because it feels like it was someone trying to paint these charming scallies, lovable rogues, but someone not knowing the reality of it all. So it becomes, again...
Yeah, she was from Liverpool, apparently, Carla Lane. And you know, she did the Live of Birds and stuff, which was very sitcom-y kind of, you know. But when it got to that, but you can watch episodes of Bread, and it makes you want to put your fist through a window as a Liverpool person, because you go, you've got the grandfather, and also as well, a lot of it's got it down to BBC casting, which was atrocious. It was like two Scouse accents in the entire family, and everyone else was just like talking like this. They had a granddad up the road going, where's my tea? It was just this weird amalgam of crap that was put together. And I always remember a great story. Jean Bolt, who played the Ma and, you know, in Bread. I think she's married to Carl Davis, famous composer, and he was at the Liverpool Philharmonic at the time. And she got off a train at Lime Street Station and jumped in the cab and went such and such a place. And the cab driver's driving the road and looked in his rear view mirror and said, "Are you that woman out of Bread?" And she said, "Yes, I am." And he pulled up and said, "Get out." I'm not taking it. And that was the thought, it was horrible.
Yeah.
Just turn on the TV and have this terrible betrayal of who you were.
Yeah.
And of course, the rest of the country go, well, they are like that, you know. It's, yeah, they are terribly yeah. northern. And, you know, you forget the damage that something like that does. So I think that,
again, particularly at a time where, the as silly as it sounds, still then the world was that bit smaller. People, yeah. it sounds stupid, but people didn't leave their own town and village as much. So that was... And that was all a lot of people would get of Liverpool. Oh, I know that now.
Yeah, exactly, that's it.
I know what they are.
Yeah, exactly so, what that's like.
Like now I think we are in a world where far more people, I don't know if it's just because of touring and I'm mixed with that kind of, but it feels like everyone is far more well-travelled, at least in the UK.
Yeah, I think it is. Know? And I think there's much more of a culture now of let's go away for the weekend. And it's brilliant, it's fantastic, because people aren't as insular, people aren't as like, well, I'll stay here, stay here when I'm safe. Yeah. No, it's not. The people are moving around, and there's much more of a multicultural thing going on, and that's think that is a fantastic thing, you know.
So how did the connection with Peter Kay come about? Because I think that was really the kick-off point for everything. At first with the Peter Kay show, but then far more magnified and even more so with Phoenix Nights, just blowing up and being the perfect thing at that time from Peter Kay. I think he'd blown up and people were excited about him, but no one really knew what... I think there was a lot of faith in him, but no one knew what he was going to come up with or come out with, and it seemed to land.
What happened was I started getting stronger and stronger doing stand-up, and I was doing more gigs and stuff, and then I thought... Because I only really wanted to get into stand-up to be an actor, to get away from
it.
It was a segue, it was a contrived, conscious decision to go. Because I remember turning the TV on once, and it was Hugh Laurie and Emma Thompson, and all these people were doing comedy sitcoms or sketch shows. And I thought, well, they're actors.
Yeah.
So I thought, I can do this. So what I did was I made a conscious decision to enter all the national competitions I could in one go.
Wow.
So I thought, I'm going to try and get some profile. And I'm going to try. So I entered So You Think You're Funny, and I entered the BBC New Comedy Awards, and I entered the Liverpool Stand-Up of the Year Award, and I entered City Life, which is the big Manchester one that Cal Anahan had won, and John Vegas and Peter won it previously. Yeah. And so I just went for them all, and the BBC one culminated in a semi final in the Frog and Bucket in Manchester, which was a club that I'd been playing. Only sort of open spots and stuff. Yeah. I hadn't really been doing that much because I only started. And Arthur Smith came down to do the semi finals, and the finalists then went to Edinburgh for the televised final. And that was my first meeting with Peter Kay. The Frog and Bucket was always a great venue to play, and they had a balcony, and people were hanging over the balcony.
Yeah.
The atmosphere was incredible. And I had my wife down and a couple of friends, and I don't know whether Peter had gone on then. I think he was on after me, but I went on and I ripped it.
Yeah,
you know, the planets aligned. I don't know, and I ripped it. There was a guy on before me who was an American, and he had this really great accent. He was doing everything like this, and I thought everyone was really, really loved his accent. Yeah. So I come flying on. I went, "Hey, everybody, how are you doing? My name's Neil, and I'm from I'm from Liverpool." And it just went, whoa.
Yeah,
because they sort of got the idea that I was jumping on the back of him.
Yeah,
and I just had a really good gig, and Peter Kay always says that I walked past him, and he went, "That was brilliant," and I completely fucking ignored him.
Oh, really?
But it was because I was so, you know, if you do a good gig and you rip it, the adrenaline's coursing through your body.
Yeah, of course.
So basically what happened was...
Particularly in the pressure of a situation like that.
Because I was a Liverpool lad coming to Manchester for a semi-final. Yeah. It's always been that rivalry.
It's a competition.
Yeah.
You've got that slight comfort of it being a familiar venue. Yeah. So that probably allowed you to at least step on that stage a little more comfortable. But then to kill it under that pressure is...
Yeah, it was. It was brilliant. And then... So the upshot of it was that me and Peter jointly won it because Peter destroyed it as well. Now, little did I know, I'd never met Peter Kay before, I didn't know, but this was like his eighth gig and he was ripping rooms apart. It was ridiculous, you know. He was clearly destined for glory and destined for incredible fame because he was, well, certainly in his stand-up.
Yeah.
We didn't know what was going to come, but the stand-up, as he was incredible. He had this incredible ability to just say what he wanted to say. It was the thing that I toured once at Rich Hall, did a few tours, few gigs at Rich Hall, and Rich Hall's an amazing comic, said to me, the one best bit of advice I've ever heard in stand-up was to be a good stand-up comic, you have to make the audience believe that you don't give a shit whether they laugh at you or not.
Yeah.
And once you've conquered your nerves and you've come on stage and you say it, if you say a gag that doesn't work, well then make a joke out of the fact that gag didn't work. Don't, because an audience can smell fear.
The absolute comfort, and it's a weird comparison, but I've always I've been a fan of the rapper Lil Wayne, and people are often shocked because my hip hop and that is a little bit more cerebral or whatever. But he's always just blown me away because I've never heard someone sound so comfortable on the mic.
Yeah.
And Peter Kay's a similar one. Incredible. That it feels like you could be in the room, you could not. He's just going through his stuff, having a little chat. Incredible. So relaxed and so comfortable, no matter how big the venue.
It was an extraordinary thing to watch in the early days because you had this, hello everybody, how are you? All right, ready? He disarmed an audience with his accent and his manner. But then his material was banging as well. So
completely.
He was incredible. So we both got to the final, as did Paul Foote and a few other people. I can't remember most of the lineup now. Justin Lee Collins, funny enough.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we got to the final and we sort of got the flat together because we were from the north.
Yeah.
We were the northern representation, sort of thing. And I got to know him then, really, and he should have won it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a televised thing. Paul Foote won it, in my opinion. Peter smashed it. I don't know what the political, political winner shock.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Yeah. So we got back to Manchester. And we just started hitting it off, and we had very similar views on comedy. And he'd grown up with the Rising Damps and the Porridges and the Goons, and so we sort of hit off each other. And then Peter said, "Oh," and it was then that I got to realise that Pete was sort of on this different track. You know, he was on this different sort of stratosphere. And then Pete said, "Oh, I'm doing this thing called the A6, which was he'd been given a write commission."
Right.
And he said, "Do you want to do anything in it?" So I said, "Well, what do you want to do?" Because he knew I was an actor as well. Yeah. So he said, "Do you like writing?" I said, "Yeah." So he said, "Well, there's a character in this." His thing was called the A6, and it was him and Dave Spikey, who'd been mates for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were driving up. The A6 is the longest A road in Britain.
Yeah.
So it was like a documentary comedy about him and Dave driving up the A6 and visiting different places.
Yeah.
One of the places he visited was the Apollo Theatre in Manchester.
Right.
And he said to me, "There's a part there for a theatre manager if you want to play it." So I basically he said, you know, let's designate four or five, six pages and come up with something.
Yeah.
So I came up with this really camp, one-legged theatre boss that was like talking like that and showing Peter around and being thought of, you just starting out stand up and I've heard you off the telly, and we were doing this thing because a light had fallen on his leg during an REO Speedwagon concert. Right. He'd lost his leg and it was all this stupid stuff. So anyway, it started with that. The A6 went out and then Peter had, as well as getting to the final of the BBC's, Peter got to the final of So You Think You're Funny,
right,
and he won it,
right,
and part of that was a Channel 4 commission for one episode, a one pilot episode.
Oh, wow.
Of something.
Yeah.
So what he did was he sort of amalgamated the A6 and some of the stuff he'd seen in the A6, and he come up with this thing called The Services, which was just a one-off, which was about Peter playing various roles in a service station in Bolton, just off the A666, I guess. And he asked me again if I wanted to contribute a little character in. So I wrote this guy who's collecting money for cancer, dressed as a lion. So he's got a ciggy in one hand and collecting the cancer in the other, and just fucking. And he's taking money out. He's taking money out the pot to phone his missus, who's having an affair with his brother. It was just a really weird sort of. And then that's how that sort of started. Pete then was just flying. I started touring with Pete doing a little bit because we were mates. And, and then Pete signed with Phil McIntyre, who was a huge agent at the time at Victoria Wood and Caroline.
Right. And, wow. Yeah.
And did these massive rock gigs and rock tours with McIntyre. And then he'd gone to the services went down really well, and he went to Channel 4 basically, and they saw the star in the making, and he was offered 6 half-hour comedies, which became the Peter Kay thing.
Yeah.
So he sat down with me and Dave and said, "Do you want to write it with me? Do you want to write it with us?" So it was really exciting. It was like, I've been wanting to, and I could feel things happening then, you know. But at the same time, I'd written my first feature film.
Yeah.
I'd written a feature film called Going Off Big Time, which was a film set in Liverpool, and we'd got finance. We'd scrabbled together finance.
We greenlit
the film on 90 grand. We went to,
wow.
The director went to Fuji and said, "Have you got any cameras not being used? Can we have one?" And they gave us a fucking 60 mil anamorphic
amazing
camera, huge like cinemascope Ben Hur camera, and a load of film stock, and we shot a feature film as well, which ended up being was premiered in the Cannes Film Festival and made That's a fortune amazing. Made a fortune for people I'll never meet. But it's still part of Best of Channel 4's Best of 4 Best of British season of Film 4's.
I love that. That's amazing. Yeah.
So that was, I had that going on at the same time.
Yeah.
So we wrote the Peter Kay thing, which was 6 half-hour different ones. We had one about an ice cream seller. We had that we did elements of Taxi Driver in.
Yeah.
We had one up called Leonard, which is about Leonard the Tompkinson, which is the oldest paper boy in Bolton, based on a true character. And then, so that won the British Comedy Award. We ended up winning the British Comedy Award. So then sort of people were taking notice then.
Yeah.
And then off the back of that, Pete got another commission and he decided that the best... Looking at the six episodes we had written for the Peter Kay thing, one of them was called In the Club.
Yeah.
And it was a very different looking, but it was Brian Potter and it was Dave playing Jerry Sinclair.
Right.
And it was just basically, it was a day in the life of a really dodgy club owner in a wheelchair. And we based elements of it on the idea that supposedly Bernard Manning burnt down four of his own clubs or something in the past to get the insurance money.
Yeah.
Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But we'd had three clubs that flooded and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
So we built the series and that was the birth of Phoenix Nights, really. We sat down, the three of us, and started bouncing off each other. We bounced off each other in a way that, you know, people might never do. We wrote the first series in 8 weeks.
That's amazing. We wrote
6 half-hours in 8 weeks.
That's insane.
Shot the second draft. I mean, it was insane. It really was nuts.
The beauty of it is it's a show that allows you to grab any of the good bits or good tone or good feeling from old comedy that should be left in the past, really. Grab the good bits because it's just enjoyable.
Yeah.
But then make it modern, add modern laughs, add a side-eye look at certain things. But again, I love that fact that it allows you to go, well, I know a lot of that club comedy is awful, but it was going for a long time. There must be something good there.
It's so incredible.
It allowed you to grab those.
Well, the thing is about it, very little of Phoenix Nights is about the accidents on the stage. Yeah. It's about the ongoings. And weirdly, the three of us connected because Peter loved and used to go to social clubs like that. And they're the heart and soul of the Northwest.
Completely.
And the North and other areas around. And I think it was because it was that dinosaur and that dying thing.
Yeah.
But you would have them, you know, sitting here with the chicken in the basket on a Friday.
Yeah.
I mean, most of
and that's
people...
exactly it. It's weird because they get a bad name because of some of the acts now. So because of the stuff going on stage, but exactly as Phoenix Nights kind of highlights, that's only a portion of what those clubs were about. It was about that your mum and your nana there with you.
Yeah.
That, like, the whole family's there and you've all got your chicken and you're sharing it in a bar and the drinks are very cheap.
All the extras were club members, club regulars.
Brilliant.
All real people. To
brilliant.
But essentially, Phoenix Nights it follows exactly the same route as the things that influenced those, the Rising Damps and the Porridges and the Stepstone Sons. It was about, ultimately, about a relationship between Jerry Sinclair and Brian Potter.
Yeah.
And then all these sorts of people around them who sort of were on the peripheral. And it's actually something that's echoed a little bit in Panther, the thing we're doing at the moment, which is this world where people only really are at the best in their group.
Yeah, completely. Together. It's what I'm loving about Panther is it's a film about wrestling, but again, it's similar. It's not really about wrestling.
No.
And I'm as I've discussed a little bit, I'm a massive wrestling fan.
Yeah.
So it's one of them that I've heard about it, and I was like, oh, it's, and then I read the script. I was like, all right, this is like the wrestling is one of the small things that is pulling everyone together. But it's really, again, it's about
togetherness.
And a local society and a group of people kind of coming together rather than. It's about a working men's club, or it's about this or about that.
Yeah, I mean, Phoenix Nights was about a club that was on its knees, really. I mean, it was clinging onto a past.
Yeah.
But there was something wonderful about that world still, and also again, them anarchic qualities. I mean, we were the first sitcom British comedy to say fuck
really
on TV.
Yeah. Oh, really?
We had a scene when Brian.
I need to applaud because that's much needed. That's,
yeah. Well, we were the. I mean, Channel 4 got on them as well. For we had this. In fact, I wrote this piece where Peter's on a series of dates with this young girl played by Jo Enright, played brilliantly by Jo Enright.
Yeah.
So they go. I mean, he's in a wheelchair, but they go on these really ridiculous, inappropriate dates. And one's paintballing, so he's like stuck in the mud, getting shot to pieces. And then they go bowling, and he sort of throws the ball and then carries on himself and falls into the gutter.
Yeah.
And then one of them threw in a restaurant. And I come up with this idea that they're in the restaurants, but I did it to music, to be fair. And as the restaurant, the woman comes over with the bucket of roses, and because Pete's character's tight, he sort of, you know, chews his food, and then you see him go, fuck off. But he's doing it in company.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And then Pete said, no, let's do it loud, let's do it out loud. And so we were like, yeah. And we were constantly getting battered back and forth in Channel 4 going. And we used to put stuff in the script knowing yeah. Channel 4 would say no. Mm. Just for a laugh for that.
I love that that change has come, though. It's a weird one. I was discussing this again, like with the thing that I was writing. And having worked on two shows that went through FX, for example, and one with the BBC, and seeing the give and take and what you have to pull and pull. And the thing I said to my agent was, look, I want to find somewhere that will allow us, like, it's kind of, to paraphrase the classic freedom of speech quote of, I may not agree with what you're saying, but I'll defend your right yeah. to say it with my last dying breath. I may not want to say fuck, but I will yeah. defend my right to say yeah. fuck with my yeah. last dying breath. It's like, absolutely. I'm not saying, I might have an episode that has no, but one thing I worked on, and it was weird, because they were literally, I overheard them saying, well, we've got an allotment of fucks per yeah, episode.
That's right.
So yeah. we've got three or something like that, or yeah. two, or one. And I was like, right, that blew my mind. I was yeah. like, right, no, I want to have an episode where if I want, I'll say fuck 10
yeah,
times.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll also have the next episode. I might not say it at all, yeah, but yeah. if it's right in that story yeah, and in that yeah. script and it's natural, then it feels crazy to say, oh, you've already used your three.
Yeah, it's incredible.
You can use my three. What is this?
You can have this wonderful. You have this wonderful situation where you have someone from the BBC saying, like, you can swap a motherfucker for a cunt. I mean, literally, you can have this. Yeah. And what you can't do, interestingly, is say Jesus. anything. You can't really? Say Jesus. Yeah. You can't. The BBC, you can't. You have to change it to something else.
Crazy, isn't it?
So yeah. So there are elements of Phoenix Knight that were quite groundbreaking in a sense, because there was always that anarchic side to it, you know. There was always that.
Yeah.
It was something that was warm and cuddly for people to watch, yeah. but also had a bit of a whoa.
Yeah, you know, had that mean? Edge. But in a natural
yeah.
a way. Well, I'll start to wrap things up because people are going to start coming in for food soon. But let's talk at the end about A Peep Show, because it's genuinely iconic and revolutionary. Yeah. It changed comedy a lot. I think it should be, and off it is, but it should be put up there with the Office and these other shows that came out and said, here's something you've not seen before. Yeah. And Peep Show is the one that we've not seen since either.
No, so, it's interesting.
So the Office, it revolutionised in that there's tons of things now that are yeah. taking that element. Yeah. But how was that to work on? And
It was, and be involved. It's an interesting one. I mean, I'm the only actor who's been in all three, you know. Yeah. I was in The Office.
Yes, of course you were. In the first episode of The Office,
First series, and last episode of the first series, I got sacked and had yeah. this whole conversation about dwarves and midgets with them.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
But Peep Show was an interesting one because Phoenix Knights was doing really well, and I got a phone call. Rachel Freck was casting. It was originally called POV.
Right, yeah.
Because that's the camera. Yeah. And I went down and met the writers, Sam and Jesse, and I read for Superhands, and they went, actually, why don't you try Jeff? And I said, okay, yeah. And they explained the character and stuff. I said, well, yeah, that's something. Superhands, Mac, I think Matt King was already in my yeah, fan. He just was glorious.
Yeah, amazing.
So initially it was a lot of fun to do, but it wasn't the most, this is a really fun job to do.
Yeah. I was going to ask, because it's an unusual. What makes it unique? Yeah. Makes it unique as what makes it uniquely enjoyable as a viewer? Makes it a unique experience as yeah. the actor, because it is all POV. Yeah. So it is. I'd imagine it's actually hard to get particularly close working relationships. Yeah. I guess, and things like that, because you're doing it more to the cameraman.
Yeah.
Every scene. Well, you're going to have guys there and doing reads.
They've got to be there. The hardest part of it was because you were used to, as an actor, you were used to never looking down the lens. You, yeah. know, you don't look down the bottle.
Yeah,
you don't
yeah, do it. Yeah, yeah.
And then it was look down the bottle all the yeah, time. And yeah. like, so you'd find yourself kind of fighting this edge.
Trying not
the
to.
First series, we had a harness built with a camera, right. with a small lens that was right in the centre, bridge of top of your right. nose, right in between your eyes, which made it harder because what you want to look at is either side of what you've got to look at.
Yeah, yeah, of
so,
course.
But the biggest problem with that was that it would dig into your head. So when you took it off, you'd have to wait for the marks to go before you shot your reverse, yeah. or shot your single. So that's
fascinating. That camera is. I was watching recently, again in my obsessive need to bring myself up to speed as much as I can. I've been watching. I watched an amazing Michael Caine
masterclass.
A masterclass, and in that he's got his bit where he's saying,
"Favour the
pick
eye,
an eye. Yeah. pick the left, well, or pick the eye nearest the camera."
Nearest the camera,
because
yeah.
He was saying you. you won't notice it, but if you're going from eye to eye, it's this slight change that will lose all strength in your delivery. So I can imagine if it's in the middle, you're going to be going from eye to eye and from the middle and making an absolute mess there.
Really extraordinary trying to do it. So that was quite... I think we did... To be honest with you, I think we did half the first series like that.
Yeah.
And then we just went, look. It was more to do with the time consuming to get the marks off your head. Yeah. Because I think it had to be snug.
Yeah.
You know, they tried all kinds of things. And then they went handheld over the shoulder and then we flew with it then. But it was a lot of fun to do. But the problem was that it wasn't one of those jobs where you went for the drink with people afterwards. It wasn't. Yeah. It was a very... Olivia Colman I absolutely love. She's wonderful. Yeah, Rob, I absolutely love as well. And Dave, to be honest with you, it was a lovely cast and a lovely crew.
Yeah.
It's just that there wasn't a lot of interaction in me.
Yeah.
I was sort of coming down from the north to do this job, and it was all sort of, you know,
coming off a show that
there was real camaraderie.
Two of your really good mates that you would be in the pub with regardless, even if you weren't doing a show.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was an odd one. It was very much kind of down to the professionalism of like cut and wrap and go back to your hotel and then.
Yeah.
But then it got. Towards the latter part of the series, I've got to admit it got a bit. I found it getting a bit disrespectful to me and the character because, I was getting one word to say in one episode, and it just got a bit ridiculous. I only really carried on doing it because as a sense of loyalty, because I'd been in the first series, and I thought, well, I'll see them out.
But
I just felt, you know what? If I'm being totally honest, then why not?
Yeah.
It was disrespectful to me as a performer because I would never write to someone who'd been in the very first series of a job and all the way through. I wouldn't write them one line.
Similarly to what we were saying earlier, give them a good exit or don't.
Yeah.
I think
the character of Jeff was probably the biggest nemesis Mark has.
I was going to say, it must have been great to play the villain, but not in a drama of any sort. Really, kind of, you get that character. He's the 100% the main enemy, the main bad guy. As such.
But also, I mean, I get it on a daily basis because such is the impact that Peep Show had in this country. You know, Jeff was such an arsehole. But actually, when you look at the piece, Jeff was the voice of the people watching Mark.
Yeah,
because Mark's character is really two-faced. He's got an opinion on everyone.
He'll
look at someone and say hi, and they go, oh, I hate you arsehole, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So Jeff was the one going, you're an arsehole. Yeah. You're a dickhead. And I just felt it was unfortunate, but I felt that he should have either killed him off completely, but the drip feed of one line got a bit.
You've got to give credence there to the power of the writers. You're completely right. They've written a lead and loved character who's absolutely appalling.
He's
annoying and horrible and nasty and snarky, yet you're still on his side.
You're still on his side.
Jeff is saying, you're right, he's saying what we should be thinking, but the way it's shot and the way it's presented, we're not thinking.
Yeah, absolutely.
It could easily have been a switch that Jeff's the good guy and he's the bad guy.
Incredible writing, and Sam and Jesse are brilliant writers. Yeah. And you know, I've got a lot of respect for them. I just thought that it's sort of...
At the end there.
It's sort of left a bit of taste because you go, well, you know, I was kind of a part of a series, so if you don't want Jeff in it, like you just said, just get rid of him.
Just get an ending.
But I'd get the call every year. They've written one scene for you, and I go, like...
Really?
So I go to my agent, well, I'll just tell him to sod off, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then I thought, no, I know people like Jeff. I know the people... You know, people watching Peep Show like Jeff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I thought, no, I'll keep doing it.
That,
but there were many times, I think. Because I think from series three, we got to series nine. I think I literally did six series and probably did seven scenes in six series.
That's madness, isn't
it? Think that's a bit naff-like. But I'm ultimately incredibly proud of it as a show.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. And I said, an iconic one to have on there. When we both tweeted a picture of us, the bulk of the responses... We're talking about Jeff.
Jeff's doing
We're coming to Easter Hay, are we?
Yeah.
Don't hang out with Jeff.
And things
like that. So that was lovely. So, well, I'll wrap things up now. The tough question at the end is always a what's ahead, because in the acting industry, you generally can't talk about what's ahead. So is there any plans or anything ahead that you've got that you can?
There isn't really. Well, I'm doing a bit of stand-up. My stand-up's constant, so that'll always be there. I've got the Slaughterhouse Pub there's the Slaughterhouse Pub in Liverpool, but it's called the Laughter House. It's run by Laughter House Comedy, and I'm the resident compere there. So that's something that just gives us our...
It's constantly there, yeah.
Gives us our outlet. It gives us our thing to stay sharp and to do our stuff like that. So
completely.
That's a constant. anything else, like my career thus far, is up in the air, really. Yeah, it's, perfect. You know, I hope that the things come on. For the last 6 years, I've done a thing called Mount Pleasant, which was great, but that's been stopped.
Right, yeah.
So it's that, I'm back to that complete unpredictability of the business now.
It's what I'm loving and scared of in this industry is exactly that. And I've said it a few times. I started last year. I'd done the Bastard Executioner and King Arthur, and they were the two things I'd done, but I started that year for the first time, because I stopped touring, for the first time with zero idea what I was doing that year. I knew I had a lot of things I wanted to do, and then on January 6th, I got a phone call to say I'd got the role in Taboo, and that was the first half of the year.
Yeah.
And then it's that whole thing, and this was a similar one. I just got the call off Stevie, and it was like, shoot soon.
Yeah.
And it's petrifying for me, because I'm used to, again, as you will with comedy as well, planning a tour or booking a tour and knowing I'm going out for these dates and that's that. But it's kind of a buzz in this.
It really is a bit of it. It can
go like that.
It really is. After the last 6 years, I've been busy for the first 6 months of the year. And for the last 3 years, I did two shows back to back. So most of my year was booked out.
Yeah.
So you do suddenly go, oh, wait a minute. The floor's moving and I don't know what's going on and I've got a mortgage.
Yeah.
But then, thank God, in a way that I've been allowed to do this, because I wouldn't. I've missed a lot of jobs doing them jobs.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is a glorious job to work on. Yeah, I've met some great people like you and some incredibly talented people like you. And long may it continue. So fingers crossed.
So where can people keep up to date with you? You're on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter. It's at FitzyFella.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much. Let's go and see if catering's open.
Let's go, man.
Thank you.
Pip, thank you, Pop.
You've been listening to Scroobish Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. I mean, as you can see, just an absolute legend, and such a nice guy. So it's been amazing working with him, and he just, like, we hit it off instantly. I'm blessed to be doing these acting roles where I seem to be just landing with amazing people who just are really nice and welcoming and are teaching me a lot. I'm getting an amazing crash course in this game. So yeah, hope you enjoyed that one. I'll be back next week, as I mentioned earlier on, with Chris Fairbank, and it's a two-parter. And honestly, you don't want to miss a second of it. He's led an amazing life. I don't mean it's rude to say he's an older gentleman. He's in his 60s, and a lot of people have said in the past that I should have more older people on to hear their stories of life. And I definitely, I love that. I love sitting down with people, but Chris doesn't. I don't know. He's wise with his age. He's not some. Oh, everything I'm going to say now is going to sound offensive towards the elderly. He's not some decrepit old man. He's a wonderfully sharp, intelligent, and articulate individual with the best voice in the world. So it was great to make the first half really just about what his life was like. So not even really getting into any showbiz stuff. I guess at the start we talk a little bit about working together on Taboo, and a little bit about working together on Walk Like a Panther. But other than that, it's just about growing up in them times. And then in part two, we get into the film and TV industry, and it's absolutely amazing. So check that out next week. If you enjoyed this one, who'd be good to go back and listen to? Stephen Graham, obviously. Let's think some comedians and comedy actors. So I've had Simon Pegg. I've had Nick Frost. I've had Tom Davis. Loads of good people. So yeah, go and check everyone out. Ramesh Ranganathan, Brett Goldstein. There's a lot to sift through. So enjoy that, and I'll see you next week.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.